Greeny this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I am an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. And I don't usually do this when I first get up here, but the first thing I need to do this morning is apologize to all of you. We got our lines crossed over the department, and this testimony is prepared as if it were to be presented to the House Judiciary Civil Subcommittee. Because that's where I thought we were going to be this morning. So I apologize. I know that you are not Representative Ackerman. Excuse me. And while the bills referenced in the written testimony are bills that House Judiciary is likely to see, I can tell you what bills you are likely to see before your committee from the Department of Justice. And I would be happy at the conclusion of this to resubmit written testimony that has the appropriate bills for your later reference, if that would be acceptable to
that
you.
That would be fine. Thank you.
And again, I'm very sorry. I'm currently assigned to serve as the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. The Oregon Department of Justice, for those of you who may not be as familiar with it as others, is the attorney general's law firm. And my section, Financial Fraud Consumer Protection, is part of the department's Civil Enforcement Division, which is the civil law enforcement arm for the state of Oregon. Our section is made up of 9 attorneys, 5 investigators plus a chief, 4 enforcement officers who handle written complaints, and I'll talk to you about them a little bit later, a volunteer coordinator who currently administers 24 volunteers who staff are the Attorney General's Consumer Information Hotline, Jen Margosian, who most of you may be familiar with. Jen is the Attorney General's Consumer Information Coordinator, and then we have a small support staff. This section has historically been funded through a combination of general funds, which make up about one-third of the operating budget for the section, and then the other two-thirds is comprised of funds that we receive as a result of enforcement actions that we take under Oregon's consumer protection laws, which include the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and state and federal antitrust laws. I'm sorry, sir, did you have a question?
No, oh. I was just scratching my head.
I'm sorry.
That's what I do when I have a question.
Yes. Can I get up and get a cup of coffee?
This section has historically been funded, like I said, through a combination of general funds and funds that we receive from enforcement actions that we take against businesses that violate the laws we enforce. In 2003, the Assembly suspended all general funding for the section. So since that time, we have been self-funded. Now, as a result of our enforcement actions, we return literally millions of dollars in restitution per year for consumers. Last year, 2004, I believe it was over $10 million, and the year before that, it was a little bit over $11 million. So much of the work that we do, all of the work that we do, directly benefits the public. We are the only agency charged by the legislature to protect consumers. Our mission, more broadly, is to protect the marketplace. We accomplish this in the first instance by education and outreach. And we target our education according to trends that we observe in the marketplace. We track these trends through two main sources. One I've mentioned already, the Attorney General's Consumer Hotline, and the other is through written complaints that we receive from consumers, referrals from legislators, and from state and federal law enforcement agencies. Just a little bit about the hotline. It has been running since 1980. It began with very small. We staffed it for about 4 hours a day with the section's enforcement officers. We had 3 at the time. and they would answer calls until about 1 in the afternoon, and then they would work cases. In 1996, we began a volunteer program, and we recruited volunteers to operate the hotline in order to give the enforcement officers more time to work on individual consumer complaints. In 1997, we hired a full-time volunteer coordinator. We recruited, I think, at the zenith of the program, we had as many as 57 volunteers who filled 90 shifts a week. We broke the day into three shifts. And we also expanded the hours of the hotline from 1 o'clock in the afternoon to 4:30. And it now runs from 8:30 to 4:30, 5 days a week. So if a person calls, they will first be greeted by an electronic message, but they can ring through and they can talk to someone directly. Or they can choose options on a phone tree and obtain information about various hot topics. And we change those on a rotating basis. In 1999, the hotline received 64,000 telephone inquiries, and in 2002, more than 77 calls were received and fielded by volunteers. Calls to the hotline in 2004 have dropped to 54,700, and we think it's due in part to cuts that we've made in our program as a result of the budget reduction. One of the things that we've been able to do less of is education and outreach, and we think that the less we're out there in the public eye and present in the public mind, the less they think to call us. Now, I mentioned written complaints as well. And consumers can send us complaints either by the mail or they can file them online by going to the Department of Justice webpage. We have four enforcement officers, and these officers review all complaints that come in. They communicate with businesses and consumers, and they have two functions in this regard. One is they're looking to develop the facts of a complaint to determine whether or not it raises the possibility of a business engaging in an unlawful pattern or practice, or whether it appears to be just an isolated business transaction. The second thing that they do in each instance is that they attempt to informally resolve complaints as between the consumer and the business to just satisfy the consumer and to give the business an opportunity to voluntarily resolve the complaint. All of our educational efforts are premised on the notion that a well-informed public is less likely to fall prey to deceptive marketing practices or unlawful schemes. We coordinate our work with other public agencies like the Construction Contractors Board, Department of Consumer and Business Services, and the services to people with seniors and people with disabilities within the Department of Human Services. We also partner with private organizations, such as the Manufactured Housing Organization, Oregon Manufactured Housing Organization, the Northwest Auto Technicians Association. They deal with car repair and body shops, and also with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, the New Car Dealers, and the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. They're the used car dealers. We've always found that education is the most effective method of prevention and is much more cost-effective than litigation. When we do bring enforcement actions, we bring them mainly under Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the UTPA. We also enforce state and federal antitrust provisions, telemarketing registration laws, and we also, very rarely, but we also do employ from time to time civil RICO provisions. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act, just a little bit about that. It governs how businesses advertise and sell goods, services, and real estate to consumers in the Oregon marketplace. The law applies to a wide variety of marketplace transactions. It is not industry specific. From motor vehicle sales to healthcare providers, from telecommunications service providers to pharmaceuticals companies. And these laws apply regardless of whether or not the transaction occurs in person, over the phone, or over the internet. So it's a very, very broad-reaching law. We are a law enforcement agency, which means that we enforce laws for the public's benefit, by stopping unlawful conduct and by seeking remedies, thank you, under the law to deter future unlawful conduct and to secure restitution for injured consumers. Like a district attorney who enforces Oregon criminal laws, we enforce civil consumer protection laws. Under these laws, we have the authority to reach the conduct of individuals who are in the business of selling real estate goods and services to Oregon consumers. And through these laws, we can secure several types of remedies. One is injunctive relief. These are court-enforced orders to make a person refrain from engaging in certain conduct or to cause them to engage in certain conduct, like making disclosures. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act provides for civil penalties of up to $25,000 per violation. We also, as I said, can seek restitution for consumers, and we can seek to shift the cost of our enforcement action onto the wrongdoing company. Now, contrast this with regulatory agencies, because sometimes people think of us as being one and the same. Regulatory agencies such as the Board of Medical Examiners, the Department of Consumer Business Services, the Construction Contractors Board, they license businesses or individuals to offer certain products or services within the state, or they oversee compliance with applicable state laws and agency rules governing things such as workers' compensation, health and safety codes, or building codes. Regulatory agencies have the authority to take administrative action against the license of a person or entity. But what most administrative agencies lack, few have it, is the authority to take direct action against a person by filing for injunctive relief in a civil court to stop them from engaging in certain prohibited conduct. Administrative action by agencies against a license can result in a license being suspended or revoked, or in a refusal to issue or renew a license in the first place. Usually, state administrative agencies do not have the authority to cause a business to pay back consumers harmed by prohibited conduct, although some do. And there again, the Construction Contractors Board has a whole claims administration process, and they do seek to have contractors pay consumers back. And there are some divisions within the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which I also believe have that sort of authority, but the majority of them do not. Administrative agencies have very limited authority over those who operate unlicensed or while suspended and revoked. Their primary focus is business regulation, though most agencies also provide some services to the consumers of the businesses it regulates. Now, we work cooperatively with regulatory agencies by bringing enforcement actions to fill in the gaps where administrative agencies lack authority, or where administrative agencies have exhausted their administrative authority and the business or individual continues to operate in a manner that violates the law. In the written testimony, I won't take your time now, I've just laid out several examples of cases that we've done with different administrative agencies. I've mentioned a few times the Construction Contractors Board. We actually have an agreement with them where they refer cases to us, contractors that they've identified as posing a continuing threat to the community, and then we'll take action under state consumer protection laws. We also have done work in conjunction with the Health Division, the Department of Transportation, and the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The majority of actions that we take under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And as I said, that is a very broad law, and what it does is it basically requires, it prohibits sellers from engaging in certain conduct, making false representations about their goods or services, disparaging the goods of a competitor, and it also requires them to engage in certain conduct, like providing all the information a customer needs in order to make an informed choice. We investigate allegations of violations through what's known as a civil investigative demand. It's like a civil subpoena. And what we do is we will issue investigative demands to make a determination about whether or not a business practice violates the law, or maybe it's just a bad business practice. If we make a determination that a business has more probably than not violated the law, we will give them an opportunity in the first instance to enter into an informal resolution through an assurance of voluntary compliance. If that fails, then we'll proceed to a lawsuit. I can tell you that about 99% of our cases settle through assurances of voluntary compliance. In determining whether or not to undertake an enforcement action against the business, we consider a number of factors. Some of them are the severity of harm caused or threatened by the business practice, either the number of consumers affected, the amount of loss sustained, whether there is another agency that is better situated to take action, whether there's a pending action by either a private individual or a state or federal agency that, if successful, will achieve the same goal and substantially the same outcome as any action that we might bring. The likelihood of being able to shift costs of enforcement to the wrongdoer and recover funds for consumers, and whether the conduct at issue has been identified as a priority within the larger Attorney General's consumer protection enforcement priorities. I want to talk just a little bit about trends in consumer protection. As I said, tracking trends in consumer protection assists us in targeting our educational efforts and in identifying areas where new laws are needed. Now, each year in February, I think it will be next week, we issue what's called a top 10 list of consumer complaints, so you'll see that coming out. And there are some bills that we've introduced this session to deal with some of the issues that are reflected on the top 10. Let me tell you about just a few of the bills that you will be seeing before your committee. House Bill 2216, 2217, and 2219 all relate to manufactured housing. And these are bills, actually, that their genesis was in the 2001 session after the Attorney General convened a manufactured housing task force to deal with problems in the industry from both dealers' perspective, landlords, and tenants. That session produced a number of laws. I think there were five new laws that were passed that session. And then as we have implemented those laws and made rules according to those laws, we found just certain areas where the law needed to be refined. And these three bills essentially represent refinements of those 2001 laws.
Mr. Chair, could you tell us those numbers again?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, they are House Bill 2216, which expands the definition of what constitutes a manufactured dwelling park for purposes of certain disclosures. 2217, which expands the definition of a provider, and that has to do with, again, certain disclosures required relating to manufactured housing part packages. And then 2219, which it's a fix which would include certain unlawful practices committed by manufactured dwelling dealers in the larger body of unlawful trade practices. Now, there's one more bill as well that is not manufactured housing related, and it does relate to the industry that has topped the top 10 consumer complaint list for the last several years, and that has to do with telecommunications. House Bill 2218 requires telecommunications service providers essentially to provide a written contract or statement to a customer after they've agreed to provide service or change service. And the reason for this is that most of the complaints that we receive from telecommunications companies, by and large, have to do with the fact that people ordered services and the services that they receive are different from what they've ordered. And it's either because on the phone they didn't understand, the terms weren't clearly enough articulated, or sometimes the services that were sold are not available in that consumer's particular area. And this has been the case largely with wireless, not landline.
Chair, what would this bill do then?
Mr. Chair, this is House Bill 2218.
Okay. And what does it do?
It requires telecommunications service providers, as soon as they agree to provide service, within 10 days after they agree to provide service, they've got to provide an invoice that lays out what services are being provided and the cost of the service. It also says that from 30 days of the date that you initially request service, the consumer has an opportunity to either cancel the contract or to change their services. If they do so, still have to pay for any actual usage charges, but there would be no ability to impose early termination fees, which, as you know, can run anywhere from about $175 to upwards of $300, depending on the company that you're dealing with. So that's essentially what the bill is designed to do.
Mm-hmm. In committee, the 2216, 17, and 19 were as on the schedule to be heard next Monday.
So those are the bills that, you will be hearing before you. I know that you have other people, and I would close now and take any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Representative Shaw.
Thank you. I'm sorry to hear that people aren't calling you more because you don't have enough people to staff or do whatever it is you have to do to catch these criminals and thieves. But do you think fraud and consumer fraud has went up due to our growing problem with meth and all that stuff in the state? You see any connection there?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, in one area in particular, and it's an area that we only handle peripherally, and that's identity theft, because there's a direct correlation between the people who are knocking over mailboxes and breaking into cars and stealing bank statements and things like that, and much larger methamphetamine rings. What the criminal law enforcement people have observed is that they call them runners, will often steal personal account information, give it to the people who are actually distributing meth in return for meth, and then the people who are distributing meth are also dealing in stolen identity information, because there's an entire, that has become a commodity in and of itself. It's very valuable. It can be sold and resold in varying forms, and it's extremely profitable. There's also a connection between identity theft, methamphetamine, and counterfeiting. And so where we'll see it in consumer protection is that someone will call us and all of a sudden they're being charged for one of these, discount membership service organizations, like a discount buying club. They'll start receiving bills. They've never signed up for it. They'll get a notice from a collection agency for a merchant account with someone they've never done business with. And so that's sort of how we'll see it in our universe, is that stolen identity information is used to buy goods and services. But I can also tell you that we also hear from businesses who fall victim on the other side because they have transacted business with someone using a stolen ID. The actual person finds out about it, disputes the charge, and then the business often is left with having to absorb the cost. I think that happened up in Woodburn to a small business. It was they sold wedding dresses, I think, very expensive wedding dresses, and the woman lost about $37,000 as a result of somebody using false identity information and making purchases from her store. It was an internet transaction.
Representative Escalon.
Yes, I'm curious. We had a situation, I'm a realtor, and we had a situation where we had a real estate agent in Southern Oregon that forged some documents. This individual was only brought up in front of the real estate agency and lost their license for 6 months, which is unfortunate. They should never have had a license in the state of Oregon again, but that's, I don't have a dog in that fight. Why wasn't this individual brought up for criminal action against them by the Attorney General? Do you not speak with the real estate agency?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel?
Esquivel.
Do we not speak? We do, but we don't necessarily know what they do unless they tell us. We receive information. There are a number of state administrative agencies that will refer cases over to us like that, where they've identified someone who they've taken action against, they've suspended their license, they continue to engage in harmful conduct, or they've suspended their license but they don't have the authority to make them pay back to customers amounts that they've taken illegally. And so the agency will refer that person to us for action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Now, we only have civil law enforcement authority. We do not enforce criminal laws of the state of Oregon. That is relegated to the department's criminal justice division. But we have worked with the real estate agency in other instances. There was a real estate agent that, for example, was, I think that they were brokering homes that they sold the same home three or four times to different people. And we went after that person in conjunction with the real estate agency. I don't know why.
How do you do that?
It was back in the 80s, and this guy, he sold the same house to seven people.
Must have been getting sort of crowded.
Who took care of the water? No.
But I don't, you know, I don't have a good answer for you as to why the real estate agency didn't contact us. They may have felt that administratively the sanction that they took was appropriate.
But it doesn't matter. It was a criminal. It was criminally negligent when you forged someone's name to a document. That's a criminal offense, I would assume.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, it is a criminal offense, but we don't enforce criminal law. We only enforce the state.
Your part.
Right. Correct.
Representative Kitt.
That's okay.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. I'd imagine if all the agencies out there, the regulatory agencies, had direct contact with you more frequently, and that may be a good idea. It probably does make sense, but you'd have to have more staff to cover all that. My question is, does the criminal side of the Department of Justice, are you in constant contact with you, the civil side? I hope within the department you all are communicating with one another on a regular basis. Is that the case?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, we do on cases where we have overlapping jurisdiction, mm-hmm. certainly. And internet fraud is a perfect example where they'll identify a target or a business, and they'll immediately contact us to see if we've received consumer complaints about that business. So, yes.
Cheryl, we have a bill on our list of many bills dealing with gift cards. Are they becoming an issue? Do you have many complaints regarding them?
Mr. Chair, we do. And this might be, is this Representative Tomei's bill?
Yes.
Perhaps. Yes, gift cards have become a problem for a couple of reasons. One, I don't know if you've seen how they're packaged, but they used to be packaged in cellophane, and the packaging would just say, you know, Home Depot or Target, $25. But the front of the packaging that you could see would not contain any of the conditions under which the gift card could be redeemed. And so people would buy the gift card, and then in the back, in little tiny mice type, there were lots of conditions like if you didn't use it within 6 months, then the company had the ability to start charging you back for non-use. Or you had to use it within 18 months, and if you didn't use it within 18 months, you couldn't use it at all. It became void. The other thing that would happen is that companies would go into bankruptcy, and they would know they were going into bankruptcy, and they would continue to sell these gift cards. And then consumers who receive these cards as gifts would have no way to redeem them. And at first, although bankruptcy rules have addressed this, the companies were taking the position that they didn't owe these consumers anything. We, of course, think that they did because they have received the benefit of the consumer's money without providing the concurrent product or service. So they do continue to be a problem. There are, I think, maybe 7 or 8 states that have enacted gift card legislation, and we would be among the first dozen or so to do so.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cheryl, there are two cases that have been in the news that affect all Oregonians, and particularly people in my north-northeast Portland district. And I'm not sure if they fall under your purview or whether or not you feel comfortable commenting on them, but I thought I'd ask as long as we had you here. One is the investigation of trade school. I believe it's BCTI. And I was wondering if that fell under your purview and if you feel comfortable commenting on what's going on with that case. The second is what I saw in the paper about Marsh McClellan and their interactions with the Portland Public School District and alleged inaccurate billings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, on the trade schools, that BCTI was just, that's just been in the news recently.
I think so.
While we don't, that's the Department of Education in the first instance, and what our role has been when schools, trade schools will shut down sometimes, and students will have paid money, is that often the Department of Education will ask us to step in and try to identify funds that the school may have in an account and make provision for students to be made whole or to receive refunds or to get their credits transferred to another program. So we mostly act in a, I would say, an adjunct capacity. Now, if it's a school that is misrepresenting the sort of certification or degree that it is authorized to provide, then we've taken action against them. I mean, we uncharitably call them diploma mills. That's sort of what they are. And we work with the department, the Office of Degree Authorization. As far as the second issue, Marsh and McLennan, the short answer is yes. We do have an open investigation under antitrust statutes, and we're working with the insurance division. The insurance division is the primary agency that oversees insurance companies in Oregon, but we are working with them because the allegations are, at least the ones that are contained in the New York complaint, allege bid rigging, which is completely outside of the sorts of issues that are regulated by the insurance division. So we're looking at them for those particular practices. The insurance division has the, I think that they are handling there were seven school districts, in fact, that paid a lot more to one particular representative in the Portland office. And the insurance division has taken or is taking administrative action against that representative in the Portland Marsh office as a result of those transactions.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions, Cheryl? I guess not. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much. And again, I'll bring you corrected testimony.
All right. Thank you. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2098. And Janet, can you give us a rundown on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2098 was pre-session filed for the State Board of Architect Examiners, and it would allow the board to assess a person for the expenses the board incurs in taking action against the person. The bill would also delete a requirement that a written complaint to the board be in the form of a sworn statement, and there is an obsolete reference to criminal prosecution that's removed. Mr. Chair, the board, it appears that if you look at the first page of the bill, that the board's civil penalty authority, line 6 in the bill, up to $5,000 for each offense, that's bold language, and you might think it's new language, but they currently have $5,000 civil penalty authority that is, it's just rewritten. You can see it on page 2 in the bracketed language on line 21. So that's not new civil penalty authority in the bill.
Thank you, Janet. Could we have Carol Alford? Good morning, Carol.
Good morning. Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Carol Halford, and I'm the administrator of the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners, and I'm asking for your support to pass House Bill 2098. You should have a copy of a letter already from our board chair, Bill Sider, that asks for your support for this bill and outlines a little bit of the things that the bill does. So I'll be very brief in my testimony today. Excuse me. This bill loosens the requirement for filing a complaint with the board against architects so that it only has to be in writing rather than sworn to. The idea is to remove any real or perceived obstacles to that process. And the bill also allows the board to recover costs associated with a case against those who have violated the board's laws and rules. This hasn't been a big issue for the board in the past. Excuse me, I'm fighting a little bit of a cold today. But it is beginning to become one for the board. We have a handful of pending cases now where the costs already exceed any anticipated penalty amount we could receive. And this bill will not help with those cases, but would have an effect on future cases. You might notice from the fiscal impact statement that the last 2 years have seen more than the normal amount of compliance activity. We've been using expert witnesses at the advice of Department of Justice in those contested case processes, and that has upped the ante, so to speak, and the amount of money we spend on these cases. That is anticipated to smooth out a little bit in the next biennium. We have only a handful left to catch up on. The board spends money on expert witnesses, the Department of Justice, and the Office of Administrative Hearings, and anticipates being able to recover approximately $25,000 in the 05-07 biennium. This is important to the board because as a semi-independent agency, we're not subject to the e-board, and we must be able to support ourselves. So with that, I think I'll just say thank you for letting me testify, and I'd certainly be willing to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Carol. Does anyone have any questions? Representative Escobar.
Yes. Why is it just a ceiling of $5,000? It says not to exceed $5,000 for each offense. You just stated you had several pending that may go past that, is that correct?
Yes, we don't always assess $5,000. Sometimes the circumstances are considered, but $5,000 is the maximum amount per incident that you can assess in a civil penalty. That is rather common amount throughout the state. Most boards have either $1,000 or $5,000 as their maximum.
Now, is this on top of what it cost us to take care of this individual problem child? In other words, let's say it costs us an additional $5,000 that we have to go after this individual. Is this fine on top of that, or is it just included in the whole package?
Well, Chair Brown and Representative Escobar, currently $5,000 is all you can get, period. So if you assess a $5,000 penalty and it costs you $15,000 to prosecute it, so to speak, then you're $10,000 in the hole.
What?
This bill changes that so that you can assess the $5,000 and then assess the amount of money it costs to pursue the case.
Okay. So you have that option now?
Correct.
Is there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
And is there anyone here that would like to testify on House Bill 2098? Seeing none, with that we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2098 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2117. And Janet, can you give us a rundown on what the bill is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I start, I just wanted to make sure everyone had, we distributed some things to your office. So staff measure summary, there was a fiscal impact statement for this bill. And this morning at your place was two statutes that are repealed by House Bill 2817 are written there. And there is a proposed amendment from that the Dash 1 amendment that maintains an exemption for legal process serves under the bill, and we'll get to that in a bit, but I want to make sure everyone has their packet. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2117 is at the request of the Board of Investigators, and it would create two new types of licenses, an temporary investigator's license for investigators that are licensed in other states to practice in Oregon for a limited time, and it would create an interim license for applicants who meet specified conditions to work as investigators, partially during their time of the application process. Mr. Chair, on page 2 of the bill, there is a list of exemptions from having to be licensed, and that list is shortened considerably, and there's more general statements, but there are some people that are exempt now that would not be exempt if the bill passes. The bill deletes a requirement to carry the identification card at all times, the identification card that's issued by the board. It deletes a requirement that licensed investigators be U.S. citizens. It has additional rules and requirements for the conduct of investigators. And it would allow the board to assess the costs associated with formal disciplinary hearings. This is similar to what you heard from the previous board. There is established in the bill a 3-year waiting period for reapplication following a revocation or denial of license. And, Mr. Chair, the final thing I'm going to mention is that it clarifies that the board may retain their fines and civil penalties instead of those fines going to the general fund. There's actually two statements in the statute that conflict, and this would clarify that they can retain their fines and civil penalties. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could we have Cynthia Hamilton? And Kelly Page, please. Thank you. Cynthia, would you like to start?
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair, but Kelly Page is... I'm a board member. Kelly is our executive director, and I'm going to let her take this.
Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Page. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Investigators, and the board asks for your support for this legislation. I have a two-page written testimony, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. Basically, I'd just like to give you a little background. This board was created in 1997 in order to license private investigators. Prior to that, they had not been licensed in this state. There's currently about 8 states in the country that still do not license private investigators. During 2002, there was an entirely new board appointed by the governor and a 100% turnover in staff. And so this statutory change is kind of a result of a new board and a new staff coming in and trying to look at what works and what we felt could be improved in the statute. So there's a lot of different provisions in here. Some of them are housekeeping, but most of them we feel contribute to consumer protection or the efficiency of licensing and regulating private investigators and agency administration. During the last session, there were 3 bills that dealt with exemptions to licensure. 2 of those passed. One was to establish an exemption for expert witnesses in certain categories, and another was to exempt licensed engineers from having to be licensed as private investigators as well. Both of those passed, and both of those exemptions are still in the current law. In the proposal. There was another exemption that didn't pass, and it was actually before this committee, and we testified against that bill at the time, and it was to exempt air tracers, as in HEIR tracers. And these are people who find money, usually at Department of State lands, and then find people to match them up with the money. And at the time, this committee did not pass that exemption. And so we felt that when we were looking at these exemptions, we were defining investigative activities, and then we were looking at what the legislature had done in the last session to see what kind of exemptions they were seemed to be interested in keeping. In the air tracers, they were looking for people, and we felt that those were investigative activities, and the committee agreed with us at the time. We are trying to create two new types of licensure that we think will be helpful to facilitate people working as private investigators in the state. Janet spoke about those. We consolidated all our standards of conduct into one section. They were kind of spread out throughout the old bill, and it was kind of hard for investigators to find out exactly what they should and shouldn't be doing. We would also like to allow enforcement investigations to remain confidential until the board takes action. Right now, almost all the health licensing boards can keep their investigations confidential. Ours are public record the minute they hit the office, and so we would like to be able to proceed with these investigations and keep them confidential until, of course, the board takes action, and then they would become public record. We would eliminate a criminal penalty for not carrying the ID card. We felt that was a little harsh and that we weren't really going to try to do that, so we took that out of there. Also, we would like to allow for the cost of disciplinary proceedings to be assessed as a civil penalty. The other thing we wanted to do is allow the board to establish terms of office by rule. Right now, it's just a straight four-year term, and under the current bill, all of my board will be going away on December 31st, so we'd like to be able to stagger some of those terms. We have an additional language that we'd like to add that isn't on here yet that the board decided to try to get into this bill, and that would be an additional civil penalty. Right now, our civil penalty is $500. That's the maximum that we can assess. Our licensing fee is $550. So when we're trying to get someone to be licensed, we're actually charging them less to violate the law than to be in compliance with the law. So we're asking that a person who violates 703405 is subject to payment of a civil penalty of up to $5,000 per occurrence, with maximum penalties of up to $10,000 per year. We also have some alternate language to something that's in the bill, and that's on 703462, Section 11. And the board is unified in its desire to request that out-of-state licensees maintain a registered agent for service of process. And this is mostly, it's not so much our control over licensees. It's if an Oregon consumer wants to sue an Oregon investigator who has an Oregon license and is working here but lives out of state, it's very difficult to do that for an out-of-state resident, so to maintain a registered agent for service of process. What the board seems to be evenly split on is who should do that, whether it should be a kind of following the Oregon State Bar model, which is we would have a licensed investigator have to be that registered agent, or whether it would be another individual or a private company that people could use as their registered agent for service of process. And so I think we're going to, there are other people who are going to testify to that as well. But those, I have these two alternate languages in the appendix to testimony. So I thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. This amendment that would keep legal processors out, do you want to speak to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffer, like I said, we had talked about when we started looking at this whole thing and changing the definition of investigator, adding a definition of investigative activities. We did that first, and we said these are what we consider are to be the basic investigative activities. And so those are in the bill. They are locating or interviewing persons, locating or preserving evidence, locating or recovering property, and conducting surveillance. So we came up with four basic investigative activities. And we went from there and we looked at the list of exemptions that we had. And we said, okay, who is doing those and is not otherwise employed by a single employer or a government agency or otherwise licensed or regulated by another entity? And so that's kind of how we looked at these exemptions. So we felt that process servers do a lot of investigative activities in their work, and so we took that exemption out.
Is there any other questions? Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you expand just a little bit on the identification card aspect of a private investigator and whether they're supposed to identify themselves, and why wouldn't we encourage them to carry cards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, we issue an ID card to every private investigator, and we will continue to do that. And I am imagining that 99% of the investigators will continue to carry that card. We issue a license, but we also issue the card, and it's kind of a mini license that can be carried in a wallet. We simply felt that requiring this and having a criminal penalty for it was really unenforceable, and that that people, when people call to check on investigators, we're able to tell people if they're licensed or not. A lot of investigators also carry business cards with their name and license number on those. But we simply felt that that this was something that, that we shouldn't have a criminal penalty for.
Any other questions?
I have a
follow-up.
Just to clarify, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, so you're just taking away the criminal penalty, but they're still required to identify themselves with a card?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, they are not required to identify themselves with the card. If they were going to be required, then we would have to have a penalty. And you know, sometimes people don't have it on them, they change purses or wallets, and it didn't seem that it was really that important a thing.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
One brief one, Mr. Chair. Now, a private investigator comes around for whatever reason, I'm not legally bound to say anything to him or her, am I? Or am I? And if I am legally bound, then I'd like to have them to have their identification on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schopfer, thank you. I want to make sure I got
that
correct.
Don't worry about it.
I've been an investigator for almost 30 years, and in my training and experience, if someone wants to know who I am, I'm very quick to tell them who I am. However, I do know that there are investigators who do other kinds of work that I do not do, such as surveillance or covert kinds of investigations, that they may not want to identify themselves. I think the best practice is to do so, but I don't think that it's an enforcement issue. We can enforce it, so that's why it was written the way that it is.
Okay, Mr. Chair, please.
Follow up.
My question is, I am not legally bound as a citizen to respond to any questions of a private investigator, am I?
You're absolutely correct.
Okay. All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Is any other questions? Representative Shield.
Thanks. Regarding the three-year lag time before you could reapply, I assume that most of the cases that come before the disciplinary board would fall short of an actual revocation. There would be the chance for a person to, I guess, make amends before they are revoked. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, that's true. We do not have a lot of cases that would rise to the level of revocation. We have had one denial of a license, and one revocation in the 3 years that I've been there. So this is simply to say if we have denied your license or we have revoked your license, you can't come back to the office next week with a new application, and we have to go through the entire process, hearing, all of that, which technically you could do right now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any other testimony? Okay. Thank you very much for being here this morning. I have Patricia Volbeck. I hope I get this right. And David Volbeck, please.
I wasn't set to testify today.
You just signed in and let me know you were here.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome.
Good morning, Patricia.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patricia Volbrick. I'm the president of the Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators. And I'm here to oppose the text on page 8, 703.4602, as written. We have a number of licensees who are from out of state. I believe it's about 75 out of 700. And of those licensees, according to that text, they would have to have a registered agent who is an in-state Oregon licensee. And I think that would create a hardship for them. We don't, as investigators who are living in Oregon, have this requirement. It will only be for those who are out of state. Let me read some of the notations that I picked up off of a form of investigators. One says, I already pay $550, soon to be $650, so I hear, and meet all the same requirements as any licensed Oregon investigator. I should be treated the same as any other Oregon licensed investigator. It looks like out-of-state licensees represent about 30% of the licensed investigators in Oregon, and that is a significant number. If we all pulled out, there goes 30% of the OBI revenue from fees. Gee, I wonder where they get the difference. By my figures at the current fee level, which sounds like it's going up, license fees would go up to $715 or $845 for a licensee minimum. If the OBI is moving towards out-of-state licensees working under another resident licensee, then they need to throw out the current licensing structure and start over. By the way, has there ever been a significant problem or trend in getting out-of-state licensees to respond to OBI service process, or is this just another control issue? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Another writes, just remember, after the out-of-state licensees are discouraged from doing business in Oregon, the only ones left to support the OBI are the Oregon resident licensees. I do not believe for a moment that the out-of-state licensees pose much competition to the residents, and our absence would not change anybody's caseload significantly. There are approximately 75 out-of-state licensees at $550 each, which is about $41,250 lost if we lose those investigators. The current budget of the Oregon Board of Investigators is already going in the hole over $3,000 each biennium. As the president of the Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators with 263 members, I know we are not all in agreement on this issue. I am personally in agreement with the out-of-state members who oppose the proposed change to 703-460. We need to remove the requirement that the out-of-state licensee have an in-state licensee as his registered agent. According to an Oregon Board of Investigators member, the proposed text will encourage professionalism because the registered agent will know the out-of-state licensee. And it won't cost the out-of-state licensee anything, he said. We bar members do it for free for out-of-state bar members. I think that board member is wrong. I personally saw an internet forum post from an Oregon licensee who offered the registered agent service to any out-of-state licensee for a fee of $50 per year. I doubt anyone offering the service would go into a great deal of checking on the out-of-state person. I don't think it will encourage professionalism. I think the out-of-state licensee will be taken advantage of financially. And that is exactly why I'm opposed to the proposed text of 703-460. It will discourage licensing of out-of-state life investigators and may send some underground to do the work without a license. I am not opposed to the alternate text, see below. And below is the alternate text that the Oregon Board of Investigators came up with on Thursday evening before an emergency meeting last Friday. And that's the end of my testimony.
Thank you, Patricia.
Are there any questions?
Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you.
Could I have Ann Fisher, please?
Chair, members of the committee, good morning.
Good morning.
Much like the AG's office today, I have to start with an apology. I didn't intend to speak today. I came down to find out what the bill was about, to hear how people were looking at it. But in reading the bill, I have some concerns, and I wanted to share those with you. I was approached about the bill by someone who knew that, as a lawyer, I had issues with the quality of investigators in this state. I think that having had opportunities to hire investigators, there are good ones and there are bad ones, and I would like to see, personally, higher standards for investigators getting their license. And I think this bill goes against that. I don't take on work that I can't believe in, so we really came down to assess whether or not I wanted to take this on for somebody else. I will tell you, though, today I'm here on my own nickel, entirely my own opinion. So let me share this with you as a lawyer who's used investigators. In looking at this bill, it clearly shows a great deal of work from the standpoint of investigators or the investigative board. And so my comments are sort of the other side of the coin. The particular aspect I take issue with is the idea of a provisional investigator's license. We have a requirement for 1,500 hours of experience or completed a related course of study approved by the board or a combination of both. What that does is give the board a great deal of latitude to allow in, by rule, investigators who really haven't had the kind of training that they should have. And investigators play a great number of roles in this state, from process servers, as Representative Schaffler talked about, to really covert actions, much like you see on those cop shows on TV where they pop out of doorways and say, gotcha. I think the stronger the better, because this is the first and only opportunity you really get to make sure that the people who are licensed as investigators are competent and understand not just the law, but what are reasonable techniques and techniques that are allowed in Oregon. In looking at this bill, I see the idea of a provisional licensee goes all the way through it. Now, a provisional licensee is someone, among other things, or as Ms. Adkins said, an interim licensee is someone who hasn't made that requirement yet. So he or she has made the minimal, authorized to do work kind of qualifications, but nothing about the quality of the work or the educational background at this point. and it does not appear to contain a length of time in which a person holding a provisional permit would have to make that into the full-blown investigative permit. It does not indicate that, there are not, as written, it would appear that somebody could come in and say, you know, I've had my provisional permit now for 8 or 9 years. How about if you give me a real one? I only do this once a year, and I only do it for, I do my minimum CL or continuing education requirements, and that's about it. But, you know, I really haven't gotten the 1,500 hours of investigative work. I haven't really passed a course, but, you know, I've had it for a long time. For instance, I could get it under the standards we have here, and I don't think I should be an investigator, or certainly not licensed as one. The other issue that appears to be in here, there are a couple of other smaller things that are in here. One is that if you're going to have a provisional licensing situation, then the provisional licensing should be really working under another licensed, fully licensed investigator. Having said that, that really is to put it in a provisional nature. Having said that, I agree with the last person who testified as to whether or not you need a registered agent that is a licensed investigator. I don't think you do if you're charging them $550 or $650 to be an out-of-state licensed investigator. Then you have probably the connection. And if you didn't want to, if you wanted to have something more, certainly you could use the same thing that we use with the corporation commissioner here, where if you have a corporation, you have to have a registered agent. It's not that big a deal, and it doesn't require this kind of circumstance in which somebody will sell that to you in the way described. Couple more things having to do with denial or revocation of a license and how soon you can reapply. I think the language here is intended to deal with somebody who was denied or revoked for some significant and substantial reason. Therefore, it doesn't address somebody who hasn't met some minimum requirements. And since we don't know what the rules are yet, what those might be, I would change the language to either say up to 3 years, depending on the severity of the sanction, or eliminate the license application aspect of that so that somebody who's been suspended might not be able to come back for 3 years, but somebody who has been denied a license might be able to come back within a reasonable length of time. And finally, I do a lot of work. Actually, I do a lot of work with the Public Utility Commission and administrative hearings, and as such, I've been involved in some other bills that are related to administrative proceedings generically. And one of the issues that we've been tackling or considering has to do with the ability to get the actually investigative, whatever you want to call it, file as it is being done. And I think the language here that provides that this that the information obtained doesn't become public until the board dismisses or issues a proposed order is reasonable. I would modify it slightly to make it clear that the person who is under investigation, that licensed investigator, have access to that information, because you've set up a circumstance otherwise in which it makes it nearly impossible for someone to come back and show that that licensing procedure was unfair or inappropriate, or that investigative procedure. So I think in every agency, the folks that I've been working with, again, this is pro bono bar activities, have been supporting that those licensees, depending, irrespective of the agency, have access to some of these investigative materials so that they can provide a reasonable defense. Certainly not with investigators, but I know that there are other agencies who tend to rely on what I would call hearsay, just information they've gotten on the phone, and they make it, they take it very seriously, but it becomes engraved in stone with no way to defeat it because nobody gets access to it. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to make sure that I understand the issue regarding having an agent from Oregon, if you're an out-of-state investigator. You said that we should make the make it similar to a corporation that would file and be a registered corporation in Oregon. Could you explain to me the difference between the two, between this bill and what is in statute regarding the registration of corporations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, if you have a corporation or an LLC or a similar corporate entity partnership, you have to maintain a registered agent in the state, and you do that merely by filing a document with the Secretary of State indicating who you've designated. Now, that person, or in some cases, a business, CT Corporation, does this across the country, has to know where you are going to be, so you have to have some process to do that if you're taking on that burden. In the provision that's as written, would require an out-of-state investigator to have an in-state investigator sort of as its parent, and that you could always call that in-state investigator and say, okay, this is, we want to get Joe Blow and he's out-of-state. You wouldn't have to go to that level. You could have an out-of-state investigator designate an in-state person as part of the licensing.
So it could be an attorney, CPA, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Could I have Dave Barros and Aaron Crow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dave Barros, legislative representative of the Oregon Association of Process Servers, and we're here today to talk about specifically about line 37 on page 2 of House Bill 2117. With me is Mr. Aaron Crow, who is the president of the association, and he will make a few remarks, and then if I may, Mr. Chair, I'll make a closing remark.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Again, my name is Aaron Crow. I am president of the Oregon Association of Process Servers, and I just wanted to say, relative to 4S703 or the proposed amendments to 703.411, number 15. Private process servers in Oregon have been serving process for 57 years. And in that time, there's been no clamor outcry from the public or the legislature for regulation of their activities. The exemption is necessary to carry out the single most critical act in the litigation process, which is giving adequate notice of the lawsuit to the defendant. The process server must have the necessary latitude to comply with the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure in doing the necessary searching and checking so that an affidavit of due diligence can be prepared in the appropriate cases, such as getting an order for publication or having the judge order an alternative means of service. Process servers must deal with people who do not want to be served and do not want to be found. It is important to, it's impractical to expect a lawyer to hire both a process server and then a private investigator in order to get a defendant served. Process servers are the professionals serving process. Many private investigators only serve process as a sideline and are not well versed in the rules of procedure. Process servers acting outside their exemption is there are sanctions for that, and the association does not condone that. Accepting work or advertising for work outside the process server exemption has always been a violation of conducting investigation without a license, and the Oregon Association of Process Servers does not condone this activities, and violators should be charged. That's essentially what I wanted to say.
Thank you, Aaron. Dave?
Mr. Chairman, our request is that the exemption be reinstated. If you'll look at all the exemptions, many of the exemptions that are being proposed to be removed, they deal with employees of companies. But in the case of a line 37, it deals with a legal process serving company. And it's confusing if that's removed, whether or not all of the process servers in the state, all the companies would have to come under the licensure board for the investigators. Frankly, I don't see any need for this. I recognize that the investigators board has a terrible budget problem, severe budget problem. But I don't think it's reasonable to ask other groups to just sort of pitch in and help out by all of a sudden having to be licensed. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to flip hats for just one second. Our firm also represents Burlington Northern Santa Fe. And if you'll move up to lines 32 through 34, we would be deeply concerned about the removal of that exemption language. Railroad companies have investigators. They come from around a region. They investigate theft. They investigate injuries. They investigate a lot of things. And being a licensed investigator under the state of Oregon doesn't bring anything to the mission for them. It may even have interstate commerce implications. I'm not saying it does, but it may. So what I'm suggesting, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of problems just in that, in this one section, section two of the bill, because in some cases they would argue, I think accurately, that the new language up on lines 7 and 8 would cover a lot of employees of companies. But if the language that's being proposed for deletion applies to a company, then that company would have to become a licensed investigator. And at a minimum, Mr. Chair, I would suggest that there needs to be some conversation among the parties, which to my knowledge has not occurred, if this bill is going to be moving forward. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Dave, would line 44 and 45 and then one on top of the next page, would that essentially put the railroad investigators back in the exemption?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not certain that they're licensed by the federal government. They may be.
Okay.
They may be. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. And I guess I'm not being critical of necessarily of specifically removing that exemption. I just don't know enough, and nobody's talked about it with anybody. It's just all of a sudden appears. And I think it needs some conversation.
Any questions?
I just want to make a comment. I think I agree with Mr. Barrows that there's a lot of conversation that needs to be going on this before.
Could Mr. Paul make one final comment?
Certainly.
The current language on line 37 is, legislative counsel has advised statutory language should be modified somewhat. The Oregon Association would like to see it read a process server or person in the employ of a legal process service company attempting to serve legal process.
Which is not the way the amendment is before you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, guys, for your testimony. Jim Markey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Markey, representing the Oregon Collectors Association today. We have some concerns about the removal of some of the exemptions as well as the previous witnesses. I would just say that I know that the legislature licenses and regulates a lot of activities in the name of consumer protection. And I guess I'd like to remind the committee this morning that sometimes there's a fine line between consumer protection and restraint of trade. We went through a process in this building for a number of years called the Sunset Review Process, where elected people like yourselves reviewed all kinds of licensed people. Should they continue to be licensed? And if so, under what conditions? In that process, the legislature learned something, and that was that there's hardly anybody in this state licensed and regulated that didn't come here and ask to be licensed and regulated. Very seldom, because of some consumer outcry, are people regulated. Generally, it's people come here and want to be licensed. And I would submit to you that in some cases, there are some motives of restraint of trade. This bill removes several exemptions, and my client, the Oregon Collectors Association, collection agencies, are high users of process servers. We have in this state very professional process servers. They're not licensed. They do an excellent job, and this bill simply would require them to become licensed as private investigators if they could. Or, in the alternative, my client would hire people that are already licensed as private investigators to serve that process. I guess part of the problem in this kind of a bill that we always look to are unintended consequences. Excuse me. We're speaking this morning about process servers and their need to be exempt from the bill. There's been no discussion about landlords. I find it interesting in sub 16 on page 2 that's being removed, an exemption for a landlord or an agent of a landlord performing duties in connection with a rental property transaction. By removing that exemption and inserting the other exemptions, which only cover licensed and regulated people, I believe that a landlord who had a tenant that didn't pay him and skipped out, and the landlord was trying to locate the tenant, he'd be in violation of this law. He'd have to be licensed. I don't think anybody would intend that, but I believe it's an unintended consequence. The definition of investigative activities on page 1, lines 12 through 17, is very, very broad. Investigative activities means locating and interviewing persons, and then other things. My collection agencies that I've represented for 28 years are in the business of locating and interviewing persons. Trust me. The exemption that the proponents of this bill would tell you my people come under appears on page 2 and 3, lines 44, 45, and line 1 of page 3. A person who is licensed or regulated by a federal government or the state of Oregon while the person is acting within the scope of duties covered by the license or regulation. Now, normally, that's where the exemption would end. We have a lot of statutes that exempt people that are licensed or regulated. But these folks have added another piece, and it says, and is offering the services authorized by the license or regulation to the public. Now, a collection agency is authorized under their licensing statute to offer services to collect debts. But they're not specifically authorized under that statute to locate people. But sometimes you got to locate them before you can collect the debt. And so there's a serious question here of whether a collection agency engaged in location activity, skip tracing, if you will, or any other creditor, for that matter, would actually be exempt under this law. So I just believe there's a lot of problems with the drafting of this bill. I believe it creates unintended consequences for a lot of folks out there, and it's too bad that we didn't have some discussion before it got here. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Alan Crow. Aaron Crow. Is it?
Oh.
Excuse me. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. Were you handed out this single sheet?
No. Could I get you to give us your name for the record?
My name is Alan Crow. I'm the administrator of the National Association of Professional Process Servers. I gave a little summary of the association on the sheet that I handed to the lady over there. But basically, we're a nonprofit organization, been in existence since 1982, have over 1,600 members throughout the country. We're the largest organization in the United States representing process servers. We have a very active program of education and trying to professionalize and upgrade the industry. We get involved in legislation in the various states and with the federal government. There are two specific instances I wanted to refer to with respect to our legislation that we've been involved in. One was in 1994 with the DMV Privacy Act. We went back and lobbied before Congress and were successful in getting service of process, those persons involved in the service of process, to be allowed a permissible access to DMV records, personal information in the DMV records. Also in 1994, when the United States Post Office was closing down access to the public and virtually everybody else for information regarding change of address or box holder information, we were successful in keeping that exemption to process servers. In fact, right now in this country, the only people as a group, private individuals as a group, who have access to that information are process servers. And if you're a private investigator, you got to be acting as a process server in order to get that information. So the concern that the Congress as well as the Post Office has shown to the need for process servers to be able to do its job is quite evident there. Now, as I pointed out here, there's really, you know, we've had process servers in this country, in New York especially, going back into the 19th century, late 19th century. And process servers have a job to do. They have a tough job to do. They're always looking for people who don't want to be served, who don't want to be found, and there is an element of skip tracing and locating involved in maybe not all the services, but certainly 25 to 30% of the services are going to be classified as difficult. And you're going to have to be able to give process servers latitude, and all the other states have done so, in order to be able to serve these individuals. So to try to put up a wall here, tell the lawyer, Mr. Hawley, you can't give this paper to this process server if you expect him to do any locating at all. Lawyers give you work at the very last minute. They don't give you work well in advance. They give you work that is really at a crisis level. The statute of limitations is running next Monday. This person has to be found in order to come to court and testify. I need this person for a deposition. So you can't give this to your local process server who does a good job for you, and the process server go to the house and find this person's not there. Pick up the phone, Mr. Lawyer, I can't do anything further. I can't go next door and ask these people where this man is. I can't take down a license number off of this car and find out who owns it. There are any number. I can't go to the post office and do a PO check, which I'm the only individual in this country that can do, because we have legislation here that precludes us from doing this. So I think I've kind of made the point that it is absolutely essential that we don't put the private investigator in the middle of the lawyer and the client and the court. You need You need latitude to do the court's work because they're the ones setting the rules. They say who can serve process and how it has to be served. This comes right out of the rules of civil procedure. You do it this way, this way, this way, this way. And you do this in due diligence, you know. The court cases will tell you, okay, you go here, you do this, you do that. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to give an appropriate affidavit of due diligence.
Thank you, Mr. Crow, for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Could we have Thea Bell, please?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Thea Bell. I'm the Eugene investigator and former journalist and educator who has long advocated that the Oregon Board of Investigators start using standing advisory committees that might prevent the need to come before you in this manner every biennium for these type of word challenges. I would like to commend, however, the chairman of the OBI for bringing more law changes to the legislature. It has been needing it. And I'd like to thank the president of the Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators, to which I belong, for speaking today. My concerns are also that the definition of investigator is too broad. The bill is too big a blast for the barrel. Broadening the shotgun scatter will backfire with too many requests for definition and complaints for current staff to handle. No infrastructure is possible before the law would go into effect in October or January. It's too problematic to create rules to define an occupation not more clearly defined in the law. The board obviously wants to do this more by rule. I don't think that's feasible at this time. It could be if we did it in the opposite way. The lack of rules getting implemented in time for statutory changes has created significant hardship and ill will in the past that remains today, both inside and outside the profession. In 2000, I was instrumental in drafting legislation Senator Morissette kindly introduced that more clearly defined exceptions for more professions, not less. We wanted to include to exempt genealogists and medical investigators and others who still fall under the current definition that are not clearly defined and would not be helped by this bill, because this last bill I referred to also asked for financial disclosures of board members and other standard practices that are not included in the OBI's current procedures. The former board squelched that bill without a hearing, proclaiming they would never be required to file financial disclosures. Where we used to have Senate confirmation hearings to help screen appointed board members, we no longer have them. That was taken out of the last legislation that passed. And I realize that could be a streamlining throughout the government, but I feel it we have demonstrated a history in the past where that is used and important for an investigative board. As with Ms. Fisher, I share concerns that the confidentiality clauses are not adequate. I call it a privacy patch that's a false promise that creates also a public wall. At the same time, the board continues to seek to do more business behind closed doors while remaining less accountable. In the 2002 session, my concerns before the legislature focused on the confidentiality clause a prior board was trying to adopt. Though needed, we had to stop that broad blanket from cloaking more than anyone really wanted to. I'm back here today to say the latest privacy clause needs more work. Unlike with other professions and state employees, there are no prohibitions against staff or the board releasing any information except the personal identifiers. The language merely enables most of the board business to be done in closed session and out of the public eye, and even without the applicant, complainant, or respondent being allowed in the hearing, as Ms. Fisher pointed out. And until an actual hearing does occur, they do not have access to any of the complaint or deliberations. And that may be standard, but for applicants, too. This also gives the public false promise of confidentiality, because the board says these things are confidential, but it can still release them at any time and discuss them in open session. There's no prohibition to prevent any of this being discussed, only to keep the board from being required to release it. At the very least, I ask you to take the words applicant and confidential removed from the current language. And then I had a concern about the I wasn't able to find the reference for you. Somewhere in Section 10, I believe it said that it creates a mandate for investigators to be responsible for everyone they use to perform services. And I think this is more drastic than for attorneys, doctors, and even freight brokers who rely on other licensing insurance to ensure accountability, not their own licensing laws. Most independent investigators who are affected by this statute outsource a lot of their tasks all around the country. They ask other people to pull records, do interviews, use translators and transcription, as well as doing them themselves. And there are many other services that they may hire just for one day. And I think employees are already covered by other laws. Few independent investigators maintain permanent employees. I think at least one bar rule only requires attorneys to know a violation. That it requires the attorney to actually know about a violation in order to be held accountable. This goes much further than that. We would not have to even know about a violation to be held accountable for. For somebody who's operating on our behalf to do a small service somewhere else in the country, this should be covered by our insurance. I don't think it needs to be in the legislation. So the bill goes into much further than it should and creates a nightmare of enforcement. The fees are what's pushing. The fees are expected to raise to push the budget through. And I feel that these concerns and the bill will explode this workload beyond what the board can handle with this proposed budget. I'm not convinced the fallout rate of the overburdened cardholders has been factored into expectations of greater revenue. I join others in seeking an alternative structure, such as becoming a semi-independent agency, which has never really been looked at. And we have that option to help reduce some of the staff workload and expenses, and maybe make it easier to keep track of things. Or we could possibly go in under the DPSSG, as it has been mentioned, might be reconsidered by some of the other investigators now that the board has grown. So one thing that's not in my written testimony is that I also have a concern about board members changing the length of their terms by rule instead of by law. They're asking that they be able to determine their own terms at their own leisure in their own way. And once again, I feel that that needs to be set by the only oversight that the agency has, and that's the legislature. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Are there any questions?
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you again for your testimony. Let's see. That was the last person that was signed up to testify, and with that, I'm going to close the public hearing. And Janet, do we have anything else this morning? We have nothing else. Did the committee have anything? Say nothing. If not, we're adjourned. Thank you.